Blog Talk Radio.
Here of the Story Blender, of course, hosted by author Stephen James and Susan May Warren. Tonight's guest is actor, writer, producer, and improv artist Joe Boyd. Make sure you stick around and hear that one. That is going to be very interesting. We want to let you know, of course, that all shows here on Swiss Radio are brought to you by KensingtonBooks.com and Kensington Publishing. Make sure you go to KensingtonBooks.com for more information and find out everything they got going on. Also, make sure you want to check out Dark Renaissance Books, and the latest book by Kevin Hurley, Cut and Cover, is out for you. We want to wish you all this a very happy holiday. This is the last Story Blender of 2015, and we'll be back in 2016, right around January the 8th, 9th, somewhere around that area. So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and don't miss any of the shows. So let's go right now and hit it with the last show for the Story Blender of 2015. Stephen and Susan, let's take it away.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Susan May Warren.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And Susan, today, the guy that we get to interview, I met a few years ago, and he has one of the most diverse backgrounds of any of the guests that we've ever had on.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm excited to meet him.
Well, Joe Boyd graduated from seminary and went on to work as an ordained minister in Las Vegas, Nevada, before becoming a full-time actor, writer, and producer in 2003. He played in the Tony and Tina's Wedding at the Rio Hotel in Las Vegas for more than 500 shows before moving to Los Angeles in 2005. A highly trained and experienced improv actor, Joe also has recently taken on several dramatic roles for film and television. He also travels nationally as a biblical and mythological storyteller. Joe's an award-winning film producer and writer, and he is with us today on The Story Blender. Joe, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I'm trying to remember when we first met. I think you'd either read one of my books or I don't know how, but I just remember having lunch outside of the Cincinnati airport with you on one time. and we had burgers. I still remember that. And I think
yeah,
you
me too.
Shot your straw. I think you shot your straw thing at me too, by the way.
Sounds like a troublemaker.
But Joe, one of the things that really fascinates me is the diversity of what you've done. You've done improv, you've done stage work, you've also been in films, you do one-person shows, you even worked as a minister, pastor, teacher for a while. And at the heart of everything that you've done lies this passion for telling a great story. And so just tell us a little bit about maybe how did you get that passion to really draw people into stories, and what is one of the keys that you always look at when you're developing a story, whether it's for a one-person show or a screenplay or script? What's something that really motivates you to move in the direction of that story?
I have done a lot of things, and that's you can look at that both ways, right? So that means I've never found the one thing that I'm that can keep me happy for very long. But storytelling has definitely been the theme. And I think I'm an only child, vivid imagination, very visual thinker. So I think I guess everyone thinks in story, right? Who knows?
So.
We don't really know how other people think. But to me, it was always easy for me as a kid to use my imagination to see something, just see someone walking down the street and create a backstory for them. Like, I wasn't doing it on purpose. I was just thinking, I wonder where that person came from. And so in my spare time, without knowing it, I was creating stories. I grew up pretty religious in evangelical tradition, and that's a whole nother show. But the what it gave me was, you know, some religious baggage, probably like everyone else, but the good stuff it gave me were actually the narratives of the scriptures. So I remember going to Sunday school as a kid and learning the stories from Genesis and Exodus and the stories of Jesus. And they had these things called flannel graphs back then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm 42, which means I'm just old enough to have missed all technology as a kid. And so they would have these little cardboard cutouts and put them on boards. And I just remember being aware that the other kids were bored and not understanding why, because these stories just seem so fantastical to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then my favorite teacher in high school is my history teacher, Mr. Elwood, probably the biggest influencer as a storyteller in my life. And I just couldn't wait to go to his classes. I took every class he offered. And all he would do the whole time is just tell the story. You know, he's one of those very rigid history teachers, very hard tests. You know, he taught the AP classes, and the people that weren't into it never wanted to have him, but the kids that liked him loved him. And so I just remember being basically entertained for that hour.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think all that combined it just made me, I am a storyteller. So I gravitated to positions at first within the church, and then sort of realized I wasn't I didn't really want to be a full-time vocational minister. So that led me into improv at first, and then acting, and really of late I've been doing a lot more producing. I've produced 7 feature films in the last 8 years.
Mm.
And that really is helping other people tell stories, how I would think of it, you know, sort of setting the stage for them to do that. And then develop these one-person shows that are biblical themes, so sort of a full there and back again kind of story. And I'm able to tell the stories I loved growing up, the biblical theme stories outside of the church. So they're one person plays in theatrical halls, not intended to be religious at all, but just sort of an honest retelling of some of the great religious and mythical stories. So I don't know if that answers your question. You asked about the one, I would say something around empathy is what I would think of as the first key to my storytelling. So, and it goes both ways. And probably because I have an acting background somewhat, but, you know, incarnating the story you're telling, knowing what, feeling what each person would feel like in the story. And, you know, the even things like the evil person in the story almost always thinks they're the good guy. So trying to have that sort of empathy and understand what they would be going through, and then whatever, and also empathy for the audience, especially live theater. So trying to think through, you know, so it's 8 o'clock on a Friday night. They've been at work all day. Like trying to put yourself a little bit in their perspective. And if I have any, superpower, I don't know if I do, but I think it is empathy. I think I can just kind of know what people are thinking most of the time and address those kind of barriers before they come up.
Yeah, we spoke with Bob Stromberg a while ago. He's a comedian and a storyteller, and he emphasized that too, really taking your audience into consideration when you're performing, whether it's a dramatic piece or comedy or improv or whatever, is really that that understanding and empathy and caring for your audience. I think that's huge, and it's also true, I think, in writing, in novel writing and maybe screenplays, really thinking through, you know, what will be going through my reader's or my audience's mind as they pick up this book or as they, you know, turn on this channel. I think a lot of things set the tone for that. You know, the cover of the book, the title, the back cover copy, and even in a play, it would be, you know, what happens before the curtain comes, what are people expecting when they walk through the door. But keeping your audience in mind, I think, from the very beginning of performing or producing that part piece of art is huge.
Yeah, there's a... there's sort of a holy trust there, right? So part of why I, you know, I think some things in the entertainment industry, you can easily get very jaded. But I think there's a, it's a holy moment or a vulnerable moment or something, a weighty moment when someone actually goes to work and makes money, takes the money they worked hard for, and gives it to you to entertain them. And I think it's a transaction that I take seriously. So, you know, if whether it's acting on Broadway or writing a script for a film or doing an improv show and it's $5 at a dive bar, you know, it's still they're trusting me to take the time to entertain them. One of the things that I think young storytellers of all in every genre will do is try to write to be impressive and totally miss their audience. So, you know, there's a temptation that just kind of, that generally is just true of youth in general, but you know, you're trying to prove yourself and show off, and you end up writing a Sundance movie when you're supposed to be writing a Nickelodeon movie because you want to you want to prove that you can be artsy or whatever, you know.
Right.
Steven, I love your books. I think they're, you know, I think, I don't know exactly who your target audience is, but both, like, my teenage sons are now old enough, they're reading, well, Eli is my older son's reading The Pawn in that series, and I was kind of waiting. I knew he would like it. I don't know if this makes sense, but when he turned, he's 16 now, when he turned 15, I started giving him some of them. I thought that was about the right age for him.
Yeah, that's yeah, it's interesting. I don't let my kids read those books until they're at least 14 and they know me. So on their 14th birthday, I'm like, okay, you can read The Pawn.
Yeah,
that's great. Rite of passage. You know, man.
But I don't know if that's a bad. That, like, you could. I don't know. I just saw The Martian. I thought it was really well done, and it would have been so easy to make that. They just did a really good job of making it being smart enough to believe it's NASA, but not using so much, I don't know, tricky dialogue and language to kind of show off. But I just think that's a tricky thing at any level of storytelling. And related to this, one other thing I say is you almost always write for yourself and your friends, unless you think otherwise. So one of the things we've had a problem early on, you know, I have a core team of, I have a production company called Rebel Pilgrim, and we do movies and also do some corporate work. And there's 13 of us now, and we're all very similar. They're mostly all my friends beforehand. And so when we sit down and say, what kind of movie do we want to make? We have great ideas that we get very excited about that will never make money. Because there's just not enough people like us around in the world waiting for the stuff we want to see, you know. So,
right.
There's that. There's a. That's where commerce meets art, and it's a interesting hard place to live. And I always tell any artist that, you know, you will fantasize if you. So improv for me actually was therapy, right? I was a pastor at the time. I didn't think that improv would ever. Yeah, improv was never going to be a career. It was my golf. It was my thing I did on Friday nights. And it was a blast and fun. And so you always have this idea with your hobby. Wouldn't it be amazing if I could do this for my job because I love it so much?
Right.
And the truth is, it is amazing. It is really fun. But it also then becomes a job. And, you know, if you have another job and do art, you can always afford to be a purist with your art.
Right, right.
But the second it becomes your job, it's also commerce. And you're going to, as an actor, you're going to do, hopefully, a lot of toothpaste commercials. And I was the doorman on General Hospital. That wasn't on my list of dream jobs, you know.
No, that's great. That what you have to do. You do what you have to do, right, to go forward with your with what you love, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. And there's just, it's so hard to just work in any artistic field that I think people lose the joy of that. So I just have never forgotten that. My wife's a travel agent, so we get to go on cruises a lot. And I see these, you know, I see people kind of poking fun of like maybe the cheesy shows they do, or the house band that has to play for drunken tourists every night.
And
what I actually see are people doing the hard work of being professional artists.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can make fun of them all you want, but there were 100 other people that auditioned, maybe 1,000 other people auditioned for that didn't get it.
Right.
And they're earning, they're doing the hard work and making a living. So I don't actually know for your show, like how many people tend to be professional storytellers versus amateur, but anyway, that's a speech I find myself giving almost once a week, because someone will pull me aside and say, hey, I want to be a professional actor, I want to be a screenwriter, I want to be a novelist. So then they get my art and commerce speech.
So how do you keep the passion when you have to make a living at this? You know, it's like, I mean, I don't know, and Stephen and I are both professional novelists. This is what we do for a living. So, and, you know, I've got 50 books out. I don't know, Stephen, what are you up to, like 20, something like that? So, so it's, you know, but we're trying to balance that, you know, the passion versus the fact that we have to make money. So how do you, you know, what is your advice on that?
Well, when you first think you want to do it, you probably don't know yet if you really want to do it, because you don't know what it is. You don't know how hard it is yet. But then at some point you will see how hard it is. And so acting may be an easier way for me to think about, because I get that question the most. So, you know, a mom will come to me and say, my 16-year-old daughter wants to be an actor. What school should I send her to? And I say, no, none. Like, let's not, the last thing you usually want is a degree in acting. So she should be doing community theater, right? She should be acting somehow to see if she really likes it, or if it's just an extracurricular. And I don't mean that dismissively, because the best years of my life doing improv were the years I didn't get paid for it, by far. And it wasn't that the other years were bad, but my problem is I instinctually turn all my hobbies into jobs, and then I'm out of hobbies. So I have nothing fun to do anymore, and I have to go find something. So like, part of me wishes I had held improv sort of sacred and just said it's a hobby and it's my release, and I'm not going to try to be career-minded about it. And I see a lot of people, for instance, that can do – I say sometimes the best – acting job in the world is to be the best actor in your community theater. Because that, you know, in reality, you're going to get to play any role you want to play.
Right.
You know, if you're into fame, which I don't know if I am or not, but you'll be famous at the gas station or something. Somebody will recognize you. So there's, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, but there are some people that will just say, no, like, I have to do this professionally. There's nothing else for me or I'll die. Almost at that point is when I think you can sit down and say, okay, so we've got to get really great at your craft, and you're going to have to learn how to market yourself. And your main job is to get yourself an opportunity to get jobs in almost any artistic endeavor. So you usually can't control if you actually get, you know, in writing, you can't control if you're going to get your first book published, right? You just have to hustle and work relationships and do it. Once you have some success, you have more control. But then you got to sit down and think of it like a business and give yourself the time it's going to take to get some traction. Or it's a hobby that you love, and then ask yourself, what job could I do that gives me enough free time to do this hobby as much as I want to do it? It's just making that decision, and I don't think you can do it until you actually have a taste of how hard it is.
I don't know
if that relates to you guys or makes any sense, but I know Stephen, I couldn't imagine doing anything else. Like, you had that in you where you had to do this, but a couple things could have probably been different about your story, and you may have written 2 novels by now in your spare time, been perfectly happy being a professor or whatever. So it's just a matter of what you have to do, and then being willing to do the hard work for it if you want to do it.
Yeah, when you were talking about that, it made me think of Emily Dickinson. She had 7 poems published in her lifetime, and everyone was altered by an editor. And You know, and then you think, well, today, what if you sent an Emily Dickinson poem to an editor and say, go ahead and fix that, tweak that? You'd be like, no, you would never do, because it's Emily Dickinson. But,
right.
But, I mean, she wrote thousands and thousands of poems in her life, but she never, she sent one book in and it got rejected very soundly, and she never sent in another proposal again. And so I think sometimes, you know, we as artists have to be satisfied with quiet accomplishments. And I kind of like the pragmatic view that you were talking about, Joe, but also just this idea that, you know, just celebrate every step, whether it's at the community theater or this improv gig that you're doing without getting paid for it. Celebrate the fact that you're able to be engaged in this creative art form and to lead people to tears or laughter. And that's a gift to be able to share that with people and celebrate that. And who knows, maybe we'll become famous and make a lot of money, and maybe we won't. But as long as our eyes are more present on the experience that we're able to have and to also to share with people, I think we're probably going to be happier people too.
Yeah, and let it be enough, right? Let to be present in the moment is the hardest thing in all of life. So, you know, if you do love writing, then you probably ought to enjoy actually writing.
Yeah.
You know, and like, transparently, I don't very much. I like having written. So,
right.
But some people, like Brad, who writes screenplays for us, actually loves locking himself up for 3 weeks in writing. To me, that's the torturous stuff you have to do so you can perform something, which is why I am drawn to improv, because there is no writing and instant storytelling performance. And some people look at me and say, that's the hardest thing in the world to do, or that must be the scariest thing in the world to do. But it's much scarier for me to write a screenplay because, you know, it's just harder, and then people are going to assume, I don't know. There's, with improv, you always have a little bit of the grace of, you know, you got one
thing. He's making it up on the spot. So.
Right. So you hear a lot, like, you want to hear that's great, but sometimes you hear, you know, it's really great knowing it was improv. And,
right.
Yeah. So, but I'm a performer more than a writer. And I think just finding that which gives you joy and, you know, focusing on it.
Right.
Yeah, let's take that. Let's look at that for a second, this idea of, okay, so, but you also develop solo shows that you've done, it's kind of one-man shows and stuff. Talk us through a little bit of the process of taking a seed idea, whether it's developing it with your team, maybe into a screenplay or into a show that you perform. What's the process? What's the creative process from seed idea to completed form?
Yeah, there's probably two completely different products. So I'll talk for just a second about the one-person shows, because they're sort of the, in some ways, the easiest to explain because there's not much to it. So, you know, I have a degree in theology and biblical studies, and so there's a lot of people way smarter than me about that stuff in the world, but if you lined up 100 people off the street, I'm going to be in the top two knowing that stuff. So it's just what I studied. It's what I know. And that combined with my comedy and improv training and my acting training has made just sort of a unique opportunity for me. So we've developed 5 shows based on 5 biblical books. So the Gospel of John was the first one we did. So I'm basically doing a story that's already written. And I know the story, so I didn't have to memorize it. And since I'm an improviser, I'm actually prefer not to memorize it. So I've done the show 20 times, and it's never been the same. It's always 80% the same. But that's part of the empathy thing for me, is if I'm going to try to make cultural references on what city I'm in and what the audience is like. And it's going to be way different if I do it in a theater than a couple times I've done it in a church. So that to me is just like, it just took me a while. About the time I turned 40, I had enough life experience to realize one of the things I'm just uniquely able to do is I already know the story. I've studied it my whole life. I don't have to memorize it. I'm an improviser and a comedian. I'm comfortable on stage. So in some sense, I prepared for that my whole life so that there wasn't actually a lot of preparation involved. And it's not, those stories aren't like me quoting the Bible. It's very modern. It feels a little more like, major parts of it feel like a stand-up comedy special, so it's just more me sort of talking. So that's that. But then, you know, on the total flip side, collaborative side, we do feature films, which take 200 people to pull off. And we do a lot of stage shows. My team, my company, has a group called Rebel Storytellers, and we do these four-letter word shows. So we're doing one in a few weeks called Mask around Halloween. And so that's eight storytellers coming up and telling personal stories around one topic. And then we'll fill it in with live music and improv. So it's very much like a personal narrative TED Talk kind of feel, and we'll help people develop their stories. And then our director will kind of line out the story so that there's a flow to the evening. So you see that's completely the opposite. And that's where I would see myself as a producer. So like on those shows, I get to tell stories sometimes, but my main joy is actually running this company that allows us to do those shows, finding a sponsor to pay for them, and then letting people that have maybe never had the chance to tell their story, or people that deserve, are ready to tell a story but don't have an audience, to deliver that audience to them. So in some ways that feels like the grown-up stuff I do, because I've got to tell stories in lots of interesting ways in my life, and now I actually get a lot of joy on the other side of giving people the opportunity to do that. And the same is true with the movies. The last movie we did, I gave myself two lines in, you know. There's more joy to me in giving someone a break because I worked so hard to get one. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's two different. There's a very, one way I do things is very, very internal, very personal. Only child, totally comfortable with that. Introvert, I don't need to talk to anybody for weeks. I'll stare at a wall and come out and do a show. And then the other one is the huge joy of knowing none of this could happen alone. And it's each of us doing one thing that makes it work.
That's nice. I'm intrigued by the one-man shows, Joe. How long is the presentation that you typically do?
Yeah, John's the longest one. And I can do it abbreviated, but it's about 2 hours and 10 minutes.
So you haven't written a script, so you have a 2 hour and 10 minute presentation you're going to do. Do you rehearse that on your own? Do you just kind of get up and go with it? How actually do you prepare for a 2 hour show that you're going to do all just you on stage?
Yeah. One answer is I've been telling these stories as a pastor, you know, a preacher or whatever throughout my life. So The best thing I would say is I spend a little bit of time, maybe embarrassingly a little, you know, like 2 hours finding a through line to make sure that it's not just a collection of stories, but that there's some sort of theme that I'm building around.
Mm-hmm.
And then it almost is imaginative meditation. So I trust my improv skills enough that if I can see the story in my head for 2 hours and just watch it unfold, I trust myself to be able to describe what I'm seeing to the audience.
That's kind
of
cool.
Where I get stumped is if I forget what's next because I don't know the story. So I never get stuck on a word because I don't honestly care that much about the exact words. It's more about feeling and communication. And so if I just need to make sure that I can close my eyes in real time for 2 hours, watch the story happen as if I've memorized. I saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail 100 times when I was in high school. So that's an example of a movie. I could just imagine it starting right now and
right.
Know every scene. And so to me, it's about, you know, you can talk about that in very mysterious ways and not just because it's, those things happen to be scripture, but I think you could do the same thing. I've seen people do one-person shows of Shakespeare, so one person getting up and doing Romeo and Juliet. To me, that would be the same thing. Of course, if I were going to do that, it would not be Shakespearean. It would be modern English, but just telling that story. But it's like translating. It's translating what you see in your imagination to the ears of the people that are in that particular room.
Yeah, in that audience, that theater. With your background in theology and as a teacher, Bible teacher and so on, How do you tell stories that express your faith in a way that invites people of all faiths into the stories? Whether it's maybe producing a film or one person show or something, how do you actually do that in a way where people feel both welcomed and invited in, and they don't feel like, oh, he's whatever, just trying to get me to agree with him, or he's beating me on the head with something? I don't know. Whatever people's impressions might be of something like that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it. I actually sometimes I'll be introduced because my bio, right? You can take any angle. So when I'm in a non-religious context and they introduce me as a pastor, actor, and then say other words, I ask them not to do that. They tend to do it anyway. Like, so now I know I'm going up there with everyone's preconceived notions of what a pastor is or was.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they say I'm not anymore, there's also the people wondering if I've done something wrong. And so there's just like so much emotional baggage for some people, and it's so different. So sometimes people are going to give me more authority because of that, and oftentimes people are going to give me less. And so part of what I found with these shows, the easiest thing to do for me was to just, you know, in the bio, in the marked up, you know, some people knew me, but especially if I go to another town or something, to lean into my other parts of my bio, not because I'm trying to, I actually grew up evangelical, so there was a lot of emphasis on evangelism and proselytizing. Where I am with my faith now, I actually don't have that anymore. I have much more, my theology is much more now about story and truth as I understand it, and letting people be drawn to that and make their own decisions. I really don't want to try to convince anyone to believe anything anymore. But there are assumptions that I do. So, and all the Bible shows, for instance, I will say towards the beginning, you know, we just need to acknowledge today that there are people in this room that this story is very important to them. They think it's literal truth. They think all these things literally happened. They built their whole lives on this story. We need to acknowledge there are people in this room that have never even thought about this story, have never heard of it, and it's myth to them. It's fiction. And that's okay, because none of that matters right now. We're here to serve the story. I'm a storyteller. I'm just going to tell you, based on what I have studied and what I know, what I think this story meant to the original audience who heard it. And so I try to distance myself as much as possible. And of course, it's impossible in life to really be that removed from anything. But that is the posture I take. So there's no, you know, when I talked about that through line, I always try to make it something that would apply to everyone. So for John, the through line is real life. What does real life look like? In Genesis, the interesting one there was that we discovered was at the beginning of Genesis, after the first murder, Cain kills Abel. Cain says to God, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the implied answer is no. And there's all these terrible stories in Genesis of brothers killing each other and turning their back on each other and selling each other into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And the implied answer through the whole story, if you keep asking that question, which I did as I told it, is that no, we're not our brother's keeper. It's every person for themselves. But the end of the very last story of Genesis is Joseph forgiving his brothers and bringing them back and saving their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to his brothers, "How could I not save you? You're my brothers," even though they did a terrible thing to him. So to me, you know, whatever you think of Genesis, to be able to pull that through line out is something that most people are going to resonate with and want to hear and also need to hear, which is we are our brother's keeper. So
mm-hmm.
if you take something out of the story, take that. But that would be the only, like I would do only one application kind of thing like that. And the whole rest of the time is just trying to tell the story as a story, let it stand on its own without giving my opinion on it.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I teach storytelling sometimes at conferences and so on, I sometimes tell people the more you explain a story, the less impact it has. And I think often when people do tell a story, whether it's a biblical story or a personal story, like you mentioned, in the program you guys have coming up. When they get done, they say, now here's what it means. And then the longer they explain it, they drain all of the impact out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you let it, you know, you don't read a novel and then at the end of the novel it says, and this is what the novel is supposed to mean, or at the end of a movie, here's what you're supposed to take away from this movie. I mean, and a piece of art or whatever you want to call it either stands or falls on its own. And as soon as it needs an explanation, I think it's probably not complete yet.
Right. Yeah, I love that. As soon as it needs an explanation, I think you've lost the power of it. So it's like you need to be able to look at it and go, or, you know, or experience it and sort of go, okay, that's what that's about. And I love it that, you know, you had that through line that really answered the question without you ever, like you said, you could be objective about it. And so that's really fantastic. So just bringing that truth to the forefront for people to experience without having to explain it to them, I think is really powerful. So now, where do you get your material? Like in your improv shows, like not your improv shows, your one man shows. Where do you go to find material to you know, like even like Mask? I was kind of looking at your Rebel Storytellers. It looks really cool. So you have this band of people. So, you know, and they all come and bring their story. And I love that, you know, that kind of idea that you have one word that you wrap all the stories around. But so now, where do you personally go to get your story ideas?
Well, you know, obviously for the woman shows, they're rooted in. That's why I use the word mythological sometimes and not, you know, biblical, but they're rooted in these ancient myths. So they're all sort of there for you. So really it's about, we talk about mashup a lot around here with storytelling because we also do a lot of corporate branding. That's actually the side of our business that's growing the most, which wouldn't have surprised me 3 years ago. But, you know, so we do help corporations tell their stories. And so the idea of mashup, so with the Bible shows, we're taking these ancient stories, and I'm generally matching them up with pop culture. So try to make sure my references are as timely as possible, and working Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and the new Star Wars movie and whatever as examples of, you know, and you can use, you don't say you're doing this. This would be an example of trying to be too smart, but you're using Joseph Campbell's stuff. You're using Hero's Journey and pulling out, you know, and it's everyone kind of knows it, but they don't know it. So when you call, someone Yoda or Gandalf, whatever, it gets a little chuckle. But you're using these sort of cultural references, and that's the unique thing, right? So I'm taking 5,000-year-old stories in some cases and trying to tell them to American urbanites. You know, like it's quite daunting. Like Shakespeare's hard to understand. That's written in our language. So
right.
These are stories that were written in a different language and a different culture halfway around the world. And there's things that offend our sensibilities. And so to me, it's about mashing up pop culture. And so then some of the hard work for me is just making sure I'm not getting too old too fast. And, you know, you don't want to be rich a little. I always think of that. I don't know if assuming he's passed. I don't know. Maybe not. But you're still doing Nixon jokes when, you know, Clinton's president. You don't.
Right.
You don't want to be doing that. So there's some hard work to keep up with the audience. And I think for our other shows, they're mainly personal stories. And when I try to explain my storytelling style to people, I was talking about the imagination thing and just saying what I'm seeing. Sometimes the best way to explain that is, like, you have a personal story I'm sure you've told 100 times, whatever it is, the story of how you got engaged or the story of how you won the high school football game or the story of how you wrecked your first car. And you don't sit at home and practice that. You just remember it and you tell it. You've remembered it so many times over time and told it so many times that you can go into autopilot. And if you're a good storyteller, you can then make adjustments on the fly based on who you're talking to. So if you're talking to your kids about your first car accident, it can become some sort of, you know, object lesson for them not to do that. If you're trying to impress a girl at a bar, then, you know, it's a totally different thing. And I'm generally not trying to impress girls at bars anymore. But the, you know, or if you're a college professor, the point is the stories happen to you, so you know them. And if you're telling an imagined story that didn't happen to you, you have to do the work to know it as well as if it did, so that you don't have to think about what happened.
Mm-hmm. That's really an interesting way to look at it, because it's, you know, as a novelist, you know, at some point I'm the character on the page and I'm telling the story, and at some point I sort of have to know what the story is about as I'm telling the story. And Stephen and I often have arguments about organic writing versus outlining. and for me, I think that is that piece where I kind of have to know what the story is so I can approach it and then close my eyes and tell the story, you know, kind of like you're you know, seeing it as a movie and just putting it on the page. And that's how that kind of works for me. And then Stephen does it differently. He kind of sees the story as he goes and kind of tells it as it unveils. But I just think that's an interesting way to look at it, is just to say, you know, just tell the story as you see it happening. And as, you know, and so that's good stuff, good juice for writers.
Yes, so Stephen, in your mysteries, do you know, I'm going to turn the tables and start asking questions to you, but so... It would seem like mystery would be one of the hardest genres to not have an outline. Like, you know who did it, basically, right? Or are you discovering
not
that
always.
As you
know?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't know. He just goes and explores the story and lets his protagonist take over. And so his...
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
This last book I just finished, actually, about a week ago. It's mystery thriller for teens. It's called Curse. It'll be out in May, but there's a final twist in the last paragraph, or a final reveal, if you want to call it that. And that was about 2 weeks before I was going to finish up the book, where I was like, oh, I know what I could do there. So, when I wrote the book, you know, 90% of the time of writing the book, I had a different ending, you know, in mind. But when I was able to kind of land on the final true ending, the one that had the most not only impact but also insight into what precedes it, then I went back through and I had to shape and alter scenes to make that ending inevitable, but also one that people wouldn't see coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, and there have been books where I've, you know, 2 weeks out, I've changed who the killer is, or I've decided on a different you know, person. And I kind of look at it like my readers are really astute. And they're very, people today are very narratively astute, from growing up watching well-crafted television shows or movies or books, novels, and so on. And so we're very narratively astute, and I figure if I can sit down and kind of guess where a story's going to go, a lot of my readers will be able to as well. So in the case of my stories, at least, I have no idea how it's going to end. So readers are reading like, man, I had no idea where that was going to go. I'm like, well, neither did I until the very end.
I remember I was a huge Lost fan, the TV show, and I can remember articles coming out saying that the writers didn't know where it was going. And as an improviser, I thought that was awesome. And as a fan of the show, it would make me angry, because I'm sitting here trying to figure out the puzzle, and if you don't know, how in the world am I going to figure it out?
Right, right.
But... So yeah, there's always that mixed feeling in me of like, I want the storyteller to know exactly where it's going, but I truly am obviously a very organic storyteller. So there's part of me that really likes that philosophically. But, I just thought of that.
Yeah, I actually have a friend in Hollywood, and his buddies were on the team that wrote Lost, and at least according to him, you know, they didn't expect it to really even be picked up. So, and then once it was picked up, they didn't expect it to go another season and another season. So they just kept adding stuff, like this weird black smoke, and then this grizzly bear. No, like whatever. Not a grizzly bear, whatever.
Polar bear.
Right, polar bear. And then, like, this statue on part of the island, like this foot or something. They're just like, oh, this would be interesting. Let's throw it in there. And then it kept getting renewed, and they're like, crap, we got to figure out how to tie this stuff together.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I was one of those fans that was like, what? No. Let's go back. Let's do some rewriting here.
Yeah.
So, no.
I auditioned for it at the height of its popularity, so probably its second or third year.
Oh, really?
And there was such a fervor to try to get the scripts early. So you would audition, the sides they would give you, you know, the section of the script to read, were from the old Twilight Zone TV shows.
Oh, wow.
So you would actually be auditioning for a Twilight Zone TV show that's already happened. And then if you got the part, you know, filmed in Hawaii. So I didn't get the part, but what they would tell us is if you get the part, you'll get your actual script on the plane.
And oh, wow.
So that they were not letting the scripts out at all, which is just a testament to how well they were doing in terms of creating mystery and interest, whether they knew what they were doing or not.
Right, right. Well, there's a lot of shows that have that, you know, whole you know, we're not going to show what the script is kind of thing. And so, yeah, no, that's great. But I think it would be fun to be on a writing team like that. I've always thought it would be fun to write for television and just be on a team like that where you have a lot of collaborative voices. And you kind of have that at your creative agency, you know, where you have all these different – do you like working with a collaborative team like that, or do you prefer to just sort of have your own, you know, process, you know, lock yourself in a room by yourself and kind of put it together?
I enjoyed leading a collaborative team. And again, that's what I think a producer does.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if I'm being creative, I need some space. So I just need to know, like, for instance, we don't write, and some people can do this. I have friends who are sitcom writers, and I guess they sit around a table and write together, which is to me the weirdest thing ever. But so we're going to pick one person to write a screenplay, and that person's going to get some initial, you know, thoughts from all of us. We might spend half a day brainstorming the beats, and then obviously, you know, we've done it where we don't see it until it's finished, or we see it act by act and give our notes. But you know, I feel pretty strongly that someone needs to own each step of the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
So we love collaboration, but I think you can't over collaborate to a point where nothing ever gets made or done,
right,
or nobody ever feels good about anything because it doesn't have anyone's voice.
Right.
That's, I think that's the job of the producers, to get people for a movie. And I know I have done so many things, so I jump over genres all the time, but for a movie producer, the job is just to get the right people in the right seat, and then to trust them and let them do their thing.
Right.
And when it's the most magical moment ever on a movie set when the art department's worked all night and they're finishing up this amazing set, and then the actors come in and they're prepared, and the director comes in, cinematographer's ready, and they know the angle, the gaffer knows how the lights are supposed to work, and little things like lunch is on time, and the, you know, there's a magic of we all started together, went our separate ways, did what we're best at, and come back together. That's the sort of crack cocaine of movie making. That's why do it, because trust me, there are days where none of it works. But on, it's like that perfect golf shot or the hole in one or whatever. On the days it works, there's nothing more sort of, I don't know, gives you this sort of faith in humanity than seeing all these people doing what they were meant to do all at the same time. I know it's all different things. And looking around the room and realizing as the producer, you could literally do none of them. And you get to be the one that pulls them all together, but you get, I mean, I guess I could act a little, but you can't. Just knowing that everyone here is better than you at their job is one of the best feelings you can have.
That's cool. That's very cool. Can I ask one more question about that? So how did you get into, you went from pastor to improv to, you know, producer. How did you make that jump? That's a pretty big jump.
It actually makes a little sense. So did the improv thing and was, as a performer, definitely the most natural improviser, but hard to make a living doing that unless you're willing to tour all the time. So I moved from Vegas to L.A. and just started auditioning for roles, and that's when I got, you know, the soap opera gig and some commercials and smaller films, and really wanted to be an actor, and knew that I would kill it in a mockumentary, like Christopher Guest style movie. And whenever I would audition for any film roles that let me improvise, I would usually get the part. So I just decided I'm just going to make my own and do a mockumentary and star in it, so that at that time in my life, I was thinking, then I'll be able to show it to everyone. They'll see, obviously, I'm good at that. I'll get other jobs. So I produced so that I could act.
Okay.
And ended up through that process, took like 5 years, took way longer than it should have. Ended up with a very funny movie. It's a poker mockumentary called Hitting the Nuts, which is a poker term, but it's just a silly movie and really funny, low budget. But what I learned through the process was, oh, I'm probably a better producer than I am an actor. I think I'm a B-plus actor. If I'm in my sweet spot, I can nail it. But my sweet spot's pretty narrow. And Hollywood is a very competitive place. But maybe all these weird skill sets I have make me a good producer. And
right.
I might have a chance of being an A-level producer. And to finish that story out. So I started, you know, trying to produce more and realized everything you hear about Hollywood producers is absolutely true. I just met the worst people, literally the worst people I've ever met in my life are Hollywood producers. And I'm like, I don't think I want to be that. And so that's what precipitated the move back home to Ohio, to Cincinnati, and just realizing what I could be in Hollywood, what I'd be best at. I love California. I love Vegas. I love the West Coast. But that little niche of Hollywood producing, it was too slimy. So ended up coming back to Cincinnati and made 6 movies since I came back. So it's just different
like
here.
The hub.
Well, it's just a different thing. It's hilarious, really, because we've never had a movie over $1 million budget. So these are lower budget, straight to home video movies.
Right.
We're getting them distributed. I mean, they're successful for what they are,
but
the first one we did here, we had like every news channel coming to set, doing interviews with us. And Cincinnati's it's a real city. There's 3 million people here. It's not nothing. So to me, that was just the difference. Cause when you try to make a movie like that in LA, you're just in everyone's way and you're a nuisance.
Sure.
So there's something to, you know, doing something in a place where it's not necessarily known for that actually opens up, makes it harder in some ways to sell the movie and to get some credibility. Cause you still got to go back to Hollywood to play the game, to get your movie out there. But, but yeah, it's been the greatest thing we ever did. Cause people know us as the movie people in town, and not very many people actually know us at all in LA. So, it worked out well for us.
That's great. That's a really great story. I love it. And you get to do what you love, and you're finding kind of a new niche where you're bringing all these different skills together to you know, create great movies and still able to do some improv. And so, wow, this is great. You are, just as Stephen said, multi-talented. You're sort of doing all sorts of things.
The Renaissance story man. That's
yes. So. That's awesome.
Hey, Joe, we're going to wrap things up here in a second, but before we do, let's say your one-person shows, if people want to check those out, how can our listeners find out more about those and maybe catch one? And then tell us where we can find info about your agency if people want to consult with you, either brand management or stuff having to do with the stories that they're trying to share through their companies.
Yeah, thanks for asking. To answer the last question first, so my company is called Rebel Pilgrim, and you can go to rebelpilgrim.com. I've been amazed how many people can't spell Pilgrim. there's no A in it. It's rebelpilgrim.com. So, yeah, that stuff for creative consultation or video work or any of that stuff. And then rebelstorytellers.com has our online store, so if you're interested – if you still own a DVD player, we have DVDs of the shows and ways to get them digitally as well. And we post there when new things are happening. And for the movies, if you just add productions to the end of Rebel Pilgrim, so rebelpilgrimproductions.com, that will actually show you all the feature films we produced and give some more information out there.
Now, are those available on Amazon Prime or Netflix or IMDb?
Yep. Everything's available on Prime. And the DVDs of our last 3 movies are in Walmart and Target. Our very last movie to be released is called Hope Bridge. And we've typically done comedies, but it's a drama around teen suicide. So you can see that on right now it's just out on DVD, but it will be hopefully on Netflix. But you know, Netflix, by the way, is getting harder and harder to get stuff on. But that movie, the movie we had that was in theaters a couple years ago, it was called A Strange Brand of Happy, and that's a comedy, romantic comedy. So that's lots of places digitally if you just look it up. And I'm on Twitter. Okay. That might be the easiest way if all this is confusing. Joe Boyd, it's a pretty easy name. So that's my Twitter handle as well. If you follow me, then you can get links to everything there.
Cool.
Fantastic. Great. Hey, Joe, thanks for being here. And we also thank everybody for tuning in, for listening. For info about my books, please check out stephenjames.net.
And for my books, you can go to susanmaywarren.com. And information about my coaching, go to learnhowtowriteanovel.com.
And to check out more of our guests and listen to other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
See you next time.